Hello, and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Tricarci. On today's episode, we're having ourselves an accounting draft. If you know anything about me, you know that the one thing that I love more than accounting is the NFL draft. I mean, it kind of comes with the territory after you root for the Browns your whole life. So here's what we're going to do. My guests and I are going to take turns picking accounting topics that we would like to see the FASB change or improve in response to its agenda consultation that it released back in January. Three rounds, snake draft. And I have a very special guest with me today. Kevin McBride, the chief accounting officer of the Fortune 500 software giant ServiceNow, has agreed to be my draft partner. Not only does Kevin bring the preparer perspective, which I think is essential for this topic, but he's also a current member of the EITF and previously worked as a FASB fellow. Now, one quick disclaimer before we get into it. This is obviously just an exercise for fun, and we really did try to have fun with it, which I think you guys will see. But just to be clear, the draft picks that I make on this episode are my own personal thoughts based on what I've experienced in my own career. These are by no means the official views of KPMG. If you're interested in those, please make sure you read our comment letter that we will submit to the FASB, which, by the way, those aren't due until June 30th, so if this episode inspires you, you've still got time. All right, with that out of the way, let's get to the draft. Kevin McBride, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here. Love the show.
Oh, I appreciate that. Kevin, we are honored to have you on because I don't know if you know this, but you are our first external guest on the podcast. So I asked the team to get a little plaque made up for you and everything to commemorate it. We'll put it in the mail after we're done here. But in all seriousness, we're super excited to have you on and get the perspective of a preparer, especially for today's topic.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
So Kevin, before we get into it, I want to just ask you to tell our audience a little bit about ServiceNow, even though I'm sure many of them are familiar with what you guys do.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, ServiceNow is all about making work better. Our platform enables our customers to connect their people, their processes, and data across various business functions and legacy technologies for a more integrated, automated, and data-driven experience.
Yeah, it's awesome. I just saw you guys were named, I think it was 2024, the number three most admired company in Fortune software category. So that's an awesome accomplishment as well. So congrats on that.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
So Kevin, you agreed to come on this podcast, and what we're going to do is talk about the FASB's agenda consultation. And Kevin, you and I have gotten to know each other pretty well as we've been kicking around ideas for this podcast. So you've come to realize that I am a huge NFL draft junkie. I've been a Browns fan my entire life, and there's no team more synonymous with the NFL draft than the Cleveland Browns. So much so that when they made a feature film about the NFL draft 10 years ago, it was centered on the Browns. So naturally, with the draft having just happened, it inspired me to do our own version of a draft. We're going to do an accounting draft. So instead of drafting players, I thought we could draft accounting standards that we would like to see the FASB take on in standard setting. And I'm ready to go. I got my Browns gear on, and I know you're ready to go too, right?
I'm absolutely ready to go. And you know, the movie Draft Day just endears you to the Browns. So, you know, I think I have a sense of what you're going through as a fan.
Yeah, I'll be honest. The first time I saw it was in theaters and I hated it. I just thought it was the most absurd movie. I thought it was the most, it was so unrealistic. And then I just watched it again for the second time a month ago before this NFL draft. And I'm like, you know what? I actually kind of like this.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, there's some scenes like, look, there's some the quotable moments. My favorite is no one can stop a ticking clock, but the great ones always find a way to slow it down. I mean, just iconic little moments in the movie.
That's classic Kevin Costner right there. A great Kevin Costner performance. My few things that I liked was like the whole movie takes place in 12 hours on the day of the NFL draft. And the lack of preparedness by the NFL GMs was pretty comical. And in a movie that has a lot of just like unbelievable moments, I thought one of my favorites was when the fans actually cheered Roger Goodell at the NFL draft, because that hasn't happened in a very long time. But they did get one thing right, and that was at the end of the movie when the Browns fans were chanting Super Bowl right after the draft was over, because that is exactly what we do. It is our Super Bowl every year. So All right. Well, we wasted enough time on the draft day movie. I want to get into our accounting draft. Of course, with you being the guest of honor, I'm going to give you the first pick in the draft. But before I ask you to announce that pick, I want to get your thoughts on this draft class overall. Like, my first question is, you know, what do you think of these accounting prospects in general? And then second, you know, every year there's guys that teams like take off their board entirely because it's due to like injury or off the field concerns. So my second question is, were there any prospects you saw in the agenda consultation that are just off your board entirely?
Okay, good question. So let's start with a little bit of contextualization on our draft selection. I mean, first of all, most stakeholders, including investors, believe that major changes to GAAP aren't necessary at this time. So as a result, many of the topics in the ITC are focused on targeted improvements. So we're dealing with a different set of prospects here. Now, let me focus on the second question, which is what I'd sideline. I'd go with key performance indicators. I think there's more urgent issues to tackle. I mean, the FASB has been working on enhancing financial reporting for some time, and we haven't yet to see the impact of these improvements, such as segment disclosures and the disaggregation of income statement expenses, which could help users in assessing financial performance.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. We've also got the income tax, you know, disclosures coming online this year, which again will give even more transparency into a company's tax exposure. I had a few others on my list, that my do not draft list, so to speak. One was goodwill. I just think we've debated that for how long, and I just don't think there's a consensus like good answer. And then the other one I put in a similar bucket is like aligning asset acquisitions and business combinations. Like, I think this is a good parallel to the NFL draft, to be honest, because like every year there's wildly different views on the prospects, right? Like, we just saw it with Shedeur Sanders. You know, some people thought he was the best QB in the draft. Some thought he was top 10. Others thought, you know, second or third round. And then he ended up falling all the way to the fifth round to my Browns, actually. And I think we've got the same thing here, right? With a lot of these topics, where I think what we're going to see once all the comment letters are gathered is there's going to be very different and diverse views around what people think is important. And I think it's going to be fascinating, honestly, to see how the FASB prioritizes it all.
Hey, Nick, I totally agree with you there. I mean, there's, what, over 50 topics to choose from draft. And, you know, as I talk to peers about what they'd like to see, the views are, you know, wildly different. And some of that just depends on, you know, particular industry or particular practice issues they may have with certain of the prospects. So I do think that it's going to be interesting to watch.
Well, I think that's a good segue to the draft. So with that, let me officially open the 2025 accounting draft. And Kevin, you are now officially on the clock.
All right. Well, I'm going to go bold with my first pick. And it is accounting for and disclosure of intangibles. Now, to stick with the draft analogy, the FASB has been shoring up the front line for years. I think a hole in that front line is intangible assets. Now, companies across industries are increasingly investing in developing new technologies. And if you think about R&D spending, back in 1974, when the FASB released FAS 2 research and development, U.S. spending on R&D was about $20 billion, and it was more in a brick-and-mortar economy. Today, that spending in the U.S. is over three-quarters of $1 trillion in more of a technology-based economy. And the divergence of book value to market value has been growing. Now, obviously, that gap isn't entirely explained by intangible assets, but I think there's a great opportunity here to shrink the information gap by addressing intangible assets.
I love that pick, and I hate that pick because that was my number one prospect as well. So you took it before I could. But you know, to your point on market cap versus book value, I couldn't agree more. And the gap seems to be getting bigger every year, as you said. And actually, while you were talking, I checked ServiceNow's market cap, which is $201 billion. So a massive company, which is about $190 billion higher than your book value, at least if we look at Q1. So I imagine this is a big deal for you guys as you explain the business to your investors and the value proposition. So let me ask you, Kevin, like with that in mind, what you just said, would you want the FASB to take up a project that focuses on getting these things on the books? And if so, you know, where would you go with it? Would you go cost approach, fair value, something else?
Yeah, great question. Look, on the measurement, I'd follow the accounting for tangible assets, historical costs with a fair value-based impairment model. But really, I think the development of the standards around recognition and measurement for intangible assets would be a really long road. In the meantime, I think we can get some real improvements here focusing on disclosures.
Yeah, to me, this is like one of those prospects that, you know, it had got all the traits, all the tools, all the athleticism, but he needs to learn the game. It's going to take a while for him to reach his full potential. I kind of think of intangibles the same way. Like, the potential is sky high, but to get there is going to be a long and difficult journey. So I guess with that in mind, like, any ideas on disclosure you would like to see the FASB add as, let's just call it, a first step?
Yeah, I think that's right. One step at a time here, and maybe we can get some quality information out there using disclosures rather than recognition, just to start the ball rolling. But as I think about what kind of disclosures that might be useful, I think financial statement users could get more information about qualitative and quantitative data about a company's strategic initiatives that generate enterprise value through R&D programs. And so those disclosures, they can include information about major programs, the nature of those programs, and the type of spending activities, maybe even amounts along the technology development lifecycle. So in other words, you get some information out there. Maybe it's a cost-based information about spending programs as a starting point to move us down the road towards maybe a future recognition of these intangible assets on the balance sheet.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. I mean, if you mentioned FAS 2, which right now requires like the disclosure of the amount of R&D spending. And I think what you're suggesting is let's supplement that now with some qualitative, at least as a start, to say where that money's going, right? And how it fits into the company's overall strategy. I think that would be a huge improvement over what we have today. All right, well, I think it's time for me to make my pick. And, you know, with the number one prospect on my board off the table, I need to make a pivot here. And, you know, Kevin, I'm looking at my board and every draft's got that wild card moment, right? Where a team just takes a player that nobody saw coming. So like you, I'm going to start off with a bang and I'm going to pick something that isn't actually specifically mentioned in the agenda consultation, but I think it underlies several of the things that are on it. And to me, that's the concept of control. So with my first pick of the draft, I would select a project that would do two things. One, let's create a universal framework or definition to determine when someone has control over an asset or a business. And then secondly, let's use that same framework / definition for recognition and derecognition across the board, you know, for all the relevant accounting standards that would be impacted. So let me give you a little color before I ask you to weigh in. I think there's roughly a handful of different definitions of control out there, or at least different ways in which control is applied. In US GAAP, I think the most obvious examples are RevRec and consolidation. But even within those standards, you know, we've got different ways in how we think about control. Like in revenue, you know, we have one set of indicators for determining when to recognize a sale and another set of indicators to determine whether we're a principal or an agent, both based on control. And then in consolidation, we've got two different models to determine control. We've got the voting model and the VIE model. And then we also have control that's used in things like, you know, transfers of financial assets, lease transactions, including sale leasebacks, and business combinations. And each of them have their own, you know, unique set of nuances. So I'd like to align those in some way. And then secondly, I think there's a number of standards out there that don't have any explicit guidance on like when to recognize an asset or when to derecognize it or both. So things like inventory or PP&E or crypto come to mind for me. And I think in those cases, you could get to a situation where the buyer and the seller in the transaction are reaching different conclusions.
on recognition and derecognition, in which case, you know, the books of the world won't balance. And personally, Kevin, I like when things are in balance. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, in my opinion, regardless of whether you're buying or selling inventory, your PP&E, your crypto, financial assets, or a business, you should reach the same conclusion as to when to recognize on the one side and derecognize on the other, so the books of the world do in fact balance. What do you think of that?
I love that pick. How would you define control?
That's the million-dollar question, Kevin. So obviously there'd be a lot of input on this, but I actually think we've got a really good starting point in GAAP. Like, I think the definitions of control out that are out there are very similar. And to me, I think they all kind of center on two things: power and economics. And when you put those two things together, I think, you know, in my mind, that's the core definition of control. Now, I do think we'd have to work on like some implementation guidance or indicators or whatever it might be to talk about how certain things like repurchase rights, for example, factor into the assessment of control. But at least that's where I would start.
Yeah, you sound like a VIE guru.
Yeah. And honestly, though, what inspired this was crypto. There's so many different crypto transactions that are popping up and they're getting more and more complicated. You know, where like I exchange a crypto asset with you and you give me something back. You know, it could be a wrapped version of it. It could be a right, you know, to get it back in the future. It could be some other asset entirely. But usually I have the option to get my asset back at some point in the future. And there's really no guidance on how to think about this. So a lot of people look at 610, which is control, but it's got the repurchase guidance in it. So a lot of times you get to a conclusion where you don't derecognize the crypto, even though it's a little inconsistent with the economics, given, you know, how fungible crypto is. And so then I was thinking, okay, well, 842's got different repurchase guidance when you're thinking about control for a sale leaseback. And I'm just like, does that really make sense? Like, can we just get the same and get it aligned and hopefully produce the same result for similar economics? And anyway, that's where it started. So it didn't come out of consolidation, even though it kind of sounds like it. All right, let's turn to the second round, Kevin. I'll pass it back to you for your second pick.
All right, thanks, Nick. For my second round pick, I'm going to go principal versus agent. I think this is a quick fix item. Now, this is a little bit nuanced, so maybe I should apologize in advance for picking this. But to provide a little bit more context on principal versus agent, an issue here are revenue transactions that involve an intermediary, say a reseller, between the initial producer of goods and services and the end customer. The principal versus agent assessment is all about determining whether the initial producer of goods or services or the intermediary is a principal to the end customer. And that determination is important because it can affect both the timing and the amount of revenue recognized. Now, today, 606 provides guidance that focuses on whether the reporting entity controls the goods or services before it's transferred to the end customer. And hey, great setup on your first pick.
Right? There we go, man. It's like we planned this in advance.
It seems like it. But control is essential. And 606 provides factors to consider, which include the reporting entity's responsibilities to the end customer, whether the reporting entity is carrying inventory risk, whether they have pricing discretion. But in addition to 606 guidance, practice has evolved for resellers. Now, resellers may consider factors in determining whether they control a good or service, which include whether the reseller provides the good or services itself, whether the reseller can change or modify the goods or service, and whether the reseller is promising to sell a specific good or service of a specific vendor. Now, these seem like good questions to ask from the reseller perspective. I think the challenge here is understanding the alignment between the factors that resellers may be considering and the 606 factors, which to me suggests that there's diversity in practice out there for us to go address.
Yep. I mean, we've had 606 out there for, you know, how many years with people applying this in practice? Seems like a good time to step back and say, okay, what are the challenges that we're seeing? Is there a way that we can, you know, address those? And kind of like what I was suggesting with controls, like come up with a a more robust framework that could just be applied regardless of whether you're a reseller or some other intermediary.
Yeah. Should we wait for you to do your standard on control before we address this?
We might need to, although that might be a long time down the road, and I'm not, you know, holding my breath for the FASB to take that one up. But anyway, all right. So let me go with my second pick because you're off to a hot start here. So I need to catch up. And with my second pick, I am choosing something that is in the agenda consultation, at least a question they're asking. And I would choose to eliminate the equity method, at least as we know it today. And just as some context, like my main issue with the equity method is that it's really complicated, to be honest. It comes with a lot of operational challenges. And I'm not sure it adds all that much decision usefulness, broadly speaking. You know, like first and foremost, you got to determine whether you have significant influence. And Kevin, we did a whole podcast episode trying to explain what that means, but it's very hard to do. And then you got things like basis differences, which I think a lot of people struggle with, you know, figuring out if you're even in scope because of this whole in substance common stock concept. And then, you know, all the issues that arise with things like intercompany, you know, dilution transactions and then reporting lags, et cetera. So I'm just not sure all that complexity is worth it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Now, with that being said, I do think there are some specific industries and maybe situations out there where it does make sense and it is useful to report your share of the investee's earnings or losses on, let's call it an accrual basis. You know, things like oil and gas, asset management, or tax equity structures that use HLBV a lot. So we need to find a way to, you know, thread the needle, so to speak.
Yeah. This pick is close to my heart. When I was at the FASB, I worked on EITF issue 0214, which is all about the equity method of accounting. And I think, you know, back in 2003, I came to the conclusion that we should eliminate the equity method. So I'm kind of with you on this pick. But let me ask you, so if you eliminate the equity method, how do you account for the investments?
Yeah, this is where I could see a lot of different, you know, views. I think a couple of things, you know, one would be just, hey, let's eliminate it entirely. And you're just, if you don't consolidate, you're in 321. And so you're either doing fair value or the measurement alternative. You know, we could think about whether there's, like I said, some industries that get carved out of that. But I think that's like the purest view almost, right? But then as I was thinking about this, I came up with this other idea that, you know, I'll be curious to get your reaction to. But I kind of want to create a new model that would merge the old equity method, but a much simpler version of it with the measurement alternative that exists under 321 and create, call it like a hybrid position, almost like these new positions we're seeing in the NFL, you know, guys that can play linebacker and edge, tight ends that are like big wide receivers, et cetera. So let me explain what I would do here. I think first I would say, all right, you got to assess whether you have control. If you have control, you consolidate. If you don't have control, then you go to 321 and you determine if that investment has a readily determinable fair value, I think are the words it uses. If so, you're going to go with fair value through net income. But if it doesn't have a readily determinable fair value, which I think is common for a lot of these equity method investments, then this is where my new model, so to speak, would come in. And what I'm thinking is some very simple version of equity method where you just put the asset on the books at what you paid for it, and then you adjust it over time for, you know, your share of the earnings or losses and distributions and impairments. So, you know, you don't have to figure out if you have significant influence. It's just control or no control. There's no basis differences to account for, no scoping, you know, in substance common stock type stuff. But it still would allow somebody to reflect, I'll call it the performance of the investee in their financial statements. And as part of this, Kevin, I think this is an opportunity for the FASB to codify HLBV. You know, we talk about practice. This is something that's widely applied in practice, but you actually will not find that term anywhere in GAAP. So I think it would be good for the FASB to officially codify that methodology so people have something to hang their hat on.
Yeah, I think I love the idea of just eliminating it entirely, but I think you're on to something here with respect to broad application of equity method, or at least equity method concepts of picking up a share of earnings or losses that may work in certain situations, but if But if that model you're talking about results in, by and large, the elimination of equity method in those situations where we had, significant influence, I'm all with you.
So, all right, let's, I'm going to turn it back to you, Kevin, for the third and final round of the draft. So let me know where you're going out with.
All right, for my third pick, I'm going to go with the statement of cash flows. Cash is king, right? And understanding sources and uses of cash by operating, investing, financing, it's essential in understanding financial health and the cash generating capabilities of a company. Now, let me just set the record straight. I'm also going with improvements to the indirect method of cash flow. So I'm not blowing up indirect and going direct. It's improvements to the indirect method. 230 is constructed largely around the list of inflows and outflows that are classified as financing and investing activities. And generally, everything else is classified as operating. In other words, the standard is largely rules-based. You know, as a result of that, there's a large body of interpretive guidance and diversity in practices. Think of this as like New England Patriots playbook complexity. Some of the common problems in the preparation of the statement include like dealing with foreign currency. And there's a multitude of nuances with stock-based compensation and hedging transactions. And comparability, that's a common issue for users due to presentation differences in the degree of aggregation of cash flow information. But there's also like more basic issues, like take the acquisition of property, plant, and equipment. Not only do you need to separate the non-cash activity related to accrued PP&E, but you have to consider when cash actually flows on the acquisition. So, for example, if the cash outflows on the acquisition of PP&E extend beyond 3 months, that payment should be classified as financing. Now, think about the free cash flow metric, operating cash flow less CapEx. It's not necessarily intuitive. The cash flows related to the acquisition of PP&E may not be captured in the metric. So to wrap this one up, I think the standard's difficult to apply and the nuances make it difficult for the average investor to understand.
I'm with you. I used to, when I would interview people back in the day, I would ask them what they thought the most important financial statement was. And if they said the statement of cash flows, they got bonus points. So I think this is hugely important. And I agree. I mean, you gave those examples. I think the whole predominance principle too is another one that people struggle with. You know, like I buy something, I sell it, and I also rent it, and I could get different cash flows based on what's my predominant practice. Things like that are just hard to get consistency on. So would you said improving the indirect method. I didn't know if you were going to say you were going to require the direct method or not, but on the indirect method, I guess, would you want to prescribe a specific format? I feel like there's a little bit of diversity in terms of how much like detail people go into for the line items, or, you know, are you thinking something that's just more principles based?
Now, I think when it comes to determining classification, I think principles are appropriate, but I'm with you on the presentation. I think a more prescriptive format for the statement itself might be helpful for users and getting that comparability of information that it's hard to see today because of so much optionality in the presentation of the statement.
Yeah, I like that. All right. Well, let me make my third and final pick of the draft, and then we'll close it out here. And, you know, there's still a lot of good prospects on the board. There was a lot of support in my war room for, you know, things like improving hedge accounting. I think there's an appetite to better align that with how companies economically hedge their risks. We also talked about improving debt equity guidance, you know, particularly indexation. But I'm sticking with my theme of control here. And I'm going to choose with my third and final selection to consolidate the consolidation models. I think consolidation is one of those areas that's very complex in terms of working through the framework. But I think a lot of times the complexity comes down to figuring out which model you're in. Like, are you in the voting model or are you in the VIE model? But many times you don't really get a different answer. So to me, it's like, is all that work really necessary if it's not going to produce, you know, these benefits or different outcomes? So I think for that reason, it makes sense to move towards a single model. I think there's another one too, which is a little more specific. something I've always thought about with the difference between voting and VIE, which is how we think about power. So under voting, you know, you're starting with the presumption that you have power if you have a majority of the voting interests. But if any of the non-controlling interest holders have even just a single participating right, then, you know, you conclude you don't have power, you don't consolidate. You contrast that with the VIE model, which looks at power by focusing on what are the most important decisions of this business, and then you figure out who makes those decisions. And whichever party is making more of those important decisions would consolidate. You know, so let me just take an example here. Let's say, Kevin, you and I are running a business and there's 10 decisions that are equally important to the success of that business. I'm making 9 of those and you get to make 1, all right? If I'm applying the voting model, I'm not consolidating because you have a participating right. But if I'm applying the VIE model, I would consolidate because I have, you know, the balance of power, let's call it. Personally, I think that makes more sense. And so I also think aligning the models would resolve that discrepancy and would get to even more consistent outcomes based on similar facts.
So you're going not only consolidation for your third pick, but you're also going the VIE model over the voting model, right?
I think so. I just think it's, I like the framework. It is complicated. Like, look, even if you're solely in VIE and you got to figure out if you have power in economics, trust me, it is very complicated. But I do think in the vast majority of times, it produces financial reporting outcomes that are useful for investors. So yes, I would stick with that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is the analysis under the VIE versus the voting model, I think, is more robust. But I think that the challenge here is it's so complicated. And I think there's a number of situations where it might be, you know, relatively easy to reach that conclusion under voting. And like you said earlier, many times VIE and the voting model are aligned. So would you consider any kind of practical expedience that could make this application, if you go full VIE model, a little bit easier for people to apply?
I love practical expedience. I do. So yes, I'm all open. I'm open for business. You know, if you have an offer, please reach out. We're open for business. So, all right. Well, with that, I think that's a good note to end on. You know, we're practical here, Kevin, right? So I think that means the 2025 accounting draft is officially over. Now, the last step, Kevin, we need to send this to Mel Kiper and we need to ask him to grade our drafts.
Love it.
But with that, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. This has been a ton of fun.
I appreciate being here. Thank you very much.
Many, many thanks to Kevin McBride for coming on and being so dedicated to the topic. I mean, he even watched the movie Draft Day about the Browns, you know, at my request. Just a true consummate professional. And he certainly did his namesake well. I think, you know, even Kevin Costner would be jealous of his selections. So let me recap our conversation with, you know, my 3 key takeaways. Takeaway number 1. The FASB has issued an invitation to comment back in January where it's asking for public feedback on what projects it should take on in the future. Comment letters are due June 30th, and the FASB definitely takes this feedback very seriously. After all, the big 3 accounting projects that we've seen come through in recent years, Segments, Dice, Tax Disclosures, all came out of the last agenda consultation they did back in 2021. Now, that agenda consultation kind of emerged with this one central theme of disaggregation. I'm not really sure there's a similar central theme this go around. You know, as Kevin mentioned, most stakeholders believe that major changes to GAAP aren't really necessary at this time. So as a result, many of the topics in the invitation to comment are focused on targeted improvements. But that didn't stop Kevin and I from going bold with our draft picks. So let me summarize those. So takeaway number 2. I would describe Kevin's overall draft strategy as trying to improve the relevancy of the financial statements. With his first pick, he went with a project to improve the accounting and disclosure for intangible assets to help close or at least explain the gap between a company's market capitalization and their book value. With his second pick, he went with a plug-and-play prospect that many of us know, which is improving the principal versus agent guidance in Topic 606. To really better clarify how the indicators relate to the concept of control And then maybe some thoughts on trying to incorporate how practice has developed around certain fact patterns and bring that into the guidance. And then for his third and final pick, he wants to improve the statement of cash flows, namely making improvements to the indirect method on how to classify cash flows and potentially changing the format of the statement itself to improve consistency. And for my third and final takeaway, I'll summarize my own draft strategy, which I would describe as trying to simplify the accounting guidance and improve consistency. So with my first pick, I went a little bit off script and decided to take on a project that tries to balance the books of the world. And I want to do that by harmonizing the control definition across all the accounting standards and using that definition of control for recognition and derecognition. So whether it's a transfer of inventory or PP&E or crypto or even a business, you know, I'd like to see the buyer and the seller reach the same conclusion about when to put it on or take it off their books. Then with my second pick, I decided to eliminate the equity method and all of the complexity that comes with it. So basically, if you don't have control, just go to topic 321. No need to assess significant influence. And lastly, I close it out by trying to move to a single consolidation model. You know, to me, the thought here is to eliminate a lot of the complexity in applying topic 810 that usually comes with trying to figure out what model you're in, voting or VIE. I'm Nick Tricarci, and that's the bottom line. Thank you for listening, and I would love to hear what you guys thought of our draft selections, and if there's other topics you think the FASB should be focused on, you know, please let me know. My contact info is in the episode description. In the meantime, make sure to subscribe and give us 5 stars.